California.
Yes,
yeah,
and
today is still the 20th of October, 1970. My gosh. In an interview, we're talking, Eunice Collins and I are talking, and of course, you get the collegium. I mean, I always call it the collegium, but you mean the alumnus.
No,
you
I
get the alumnus.
Alumnus.
Yeah.
Well, I did, but I missed out completely on 1970, but I think how I missed out. I've been in the habit of sending $5 every year, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And
to the Alumni Association.
For the Alumni Association. And last summer I was sick, and I didn't send it. And
I don't think really that they.
That was in '69, and maybe they just cut me off the list.
Well, I don't know how they do it, but once in a while they reshuffle and. Maybe who's going through it to, don't identify you as an alumnus or something, and
which I'm not.
No, but then we have good old friends on the mailing list too.
Mm-hmm.
But are you getting it now? That's what I want.
No, I haven't had one at all for 1970.
Oh well, then you missed the last one that I wrote and all.
Yes, I did. The only way I knew about this.
Yeah.
Finley Bailey, who was among our first graduates, I don't think you ever knew him, it was way before your time.
Well, the name's familiar, yeah.
But at any rate, Finley, for many years, worked as a chemist for the West Foods in their mushroom plant up here. Within the last year, he has quit them and is in the post office as a clerk. But at any rate, he lived just a little ways down here. And Finley brought that to me. And he said, here, he said, if you didn't get your alumnus, you might be interested in this. Bill Cashins to write this. And, and maybe you ought to think about it. And
Yeah, it was an open letter, you see. It all came as kind of a surprise to me. This is something that I was going to do when I retired, you know, because I like to write, and of course
you write real well, I think.
Well, thank you. I'm surprised that people. Well, I don't. I simply write like I talk, and if I have a story to tell, I'm able to tell it and get it over with. But I was a little bit surprised, at least, when the Regents decided that, by golly, I'd better start writing my book now. And so there was no question in their mind that I better
get... That's a real good idea.
Well, I'm happy about it.
Yeah.
It's rushing me a little bit. I didn't plan to start it until I retired, and whenever that is, I don't know. But, I'm eligible for retirement in 3 or 4 years. So, but that's all right. We'll get it over with, maybe, by that time. But I'm having a lot of fun, and this is just one trip, that the only trip I planned for is to get down the coast here. I'd like to get down maybe to Oregon and see that bunch, you know.
Oh, it'd be real good if you could, because they were among the early ones.
Yeah.
And
talk about the old times. But we've had a nice meeting now at, we had one at Palo Alto, the San Francisco group. On Friday night, and then on Saturday night we had a big party at they call him Frenchie O'Neill, Francis O'Neill, one of the O'Neills.
I remember Francis. He was one of the younger ones.
Yeah, he was, and a little after my time. I think I left in '37 as a student, and he came in about that time as a freshman. You see. So at any rate, we had a nice party down there, and swapping yarns and. Now, these little tapes that I'm taking, I don't quote them verbatim, but when I get home, I'll be able to sit down and play them, and then these little stories that they tell, I'll smooth them out or select among them and do something and kind of fill in
the
story.
Yeah, I think that's marvelous to have a tape recorder.
You know, it is, because when you stop and take notes and all that, it's, in the first place, it interrupts, and you can't get it down the same way either.
No, you can't.
No. So I don't know how it'll work out. I'm no expert at this, but you have to learn things as you go along. Eunice, when did you go to Alaska? You weren't a native Alaskan. You weren't.
Oh no.
You went up there as a young girl, didn't you?
I went up there. I'll tell you how that happened.
Yeah.
My mother and dad lived in Tacoma.
Uh-huh.
Washington, and Dad was a railroad man.
Oh.
He was he used to work for the Northern Pacific.
Yeah. Yeah.
And prior to that, he followed construction. I guess Dad worked on every railroad from San Francisco clear up.
Yeah. Yeah.
To British Columbia.
Uh-huh.
And then finally, when the trains were organized and running, well,
yeah,
he was a conductor on the passenger train running out of Tacoma.
Oh, is that right?
And we lived in Tacoma,
mm-hmm,
and I was about 6 years old when my mother and Dad came to grief over another woman.
Uh-huh.
And this was right along about the gold rush. They see, I was born in 1893.
Oh, yeah.
And so just about gold rush time,
mm-hmm,
my dad took off.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't hear from him for many years.
Exactly.
And first he tried to get into Dawson, but something happened there, and he, we understand he didn't go. Well, in fact, he told us that he didn't. He came back.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to, his next try was going to Valdez, and he walked from Valdez in to the interior.
What was your father's name?
Thrift, Charles.
Charles Thrift.
Charles Walter Thrift.
Yeah.
And so Dad stayed in he just took up his residence in the Fairbanks district, and he took a fling at mining, and he did this and he did that.
Yeah.
And then for many years, he had charge of that great big red warm storage for the NC company that was right over back of Sampson's Hardware.
Oh, yeah.
Across town.
Was there for years.
And that
was
his job. He had
he
a
was
room.
The warehouseman.
He was a warehouseman. He had a room there, and it was his job to see that the temperature stayed just so on all that perishable stuff.
Uh-huh.
So it was during those years that he was there that we got track of him.
Uh-huh.
And he sent for my sister Nell. I don't know if you've met
her. Yeah.
So he sent for Nell, and that was 1911.
Was that that? Mm-hmm.
And an interesting thing about that was that Margaret Thomas Murray.
Yeah.
And her mother were on the same on the boat just ahead of her.
Oh. They went up
and
with just ahead of Nell.
Just ahead of Nell.
Uh-huh.
But in Margaret's book, you know,
she
tells about the crew.
Yeah.
And they were all the same.
Yeah. Yeah. But and did they go in by way of Dawson and down river?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes. Yeah, sure.
Skagway.
1910.
White Horse.
11, sure.
Down
sure.
the river.
Uh-huh. Then when you followed a few
and
years
then
later?
I then came the First World War for me,
mm-hmm,
and Dad was still up there. Nell was there just a year, and then she came
mm-hmm
out, and she knew Bobby Sheldon, and
yeah,
and she can tell a real interesting
is
story
that,
about the people
yeah
that she knew.
Yeah.
And her story is kind of correspond with the story that about Fairbanks that Margaret Murray tells and her in the far north.
Yeah.
Anyway, and she came outside in 1912.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the war, 1912, well, a good many years went by there. Oh, I went to school. Dad sent some money and I went to Pullman, to preparatory school. And then I went to business college. And then the war came in 1917.
Yeah.
So I worked in the shipyard during that time, and then when the war was over, in 1918 November, I wrote to Dad and asked him if he thought there was something I could do up there. I was trained for office work.
Yeah.
And he said yes, and all arrangements were made for me to go in June, which I did,
mm-hmm,
June 1919.
1919,
and I went by way of Skagway and down the river.
Yeah, and that's when you first saw Fairbanks. Then.
And that's when I first saw Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So.
Did you find that job he had lined up for you?
Yes. Well, in fact, I didn't see Fairbanks for quite a while after that because I stopped at Nenana. You see,
oh,
that was the head of...
Oh, that was big going on there.
Oh, the railroad was built.
Yes.
And that was the headquarters, the northern headquarters for the railroad construction. So I went right to work in the accounting office in Nenana.
Now tell me, did they run that Tanana Valley Railroad, the narrow gauge up to Chattanooga? Did they run a narrow gauge line down to Nenana first?
Yes.
Did
yes.
They?
Mm-hmm. And that's even after the railroad could come as far, the standard gauge was as far as Nenana.
Yeah.
There was no bridge, and they couldn't find a footing for a bridge. They had a hard time making getting that crossing. And so then at North Nenana, it was called, narrow gauge ran.
Then the equipment would turn around and narrow gauge equipment from there on up.
Uh-huh.
I see.
That was right.
Yeah, well, that's what somebody was arguing about the other day. And I said, well, I've heard it, but I don't know for sure. But it seemed to me that was, that they had narrow gauge up on the north side of that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, then you went to work. Did you work at Nenana then? Was that?
Oh,
here?
I worked at Nenana. Yeah.
All during that railroad construction.
Hmm?
During the construction of the road,
during
and they were working on the bridge too, I suppose.
No, they didn't work on the bridge until after I left.
Oh, is that
there?
Right?
The bridge was a long time in coming.
And it was partly through engineering. It was too big a span, I suppose, for the material. Or was it the war materials holding it up? Suppose
well,
the war interfered with the
that
steel.
Too.
Yeah.
Could have been that. I remember there was lots of talk about the footing, and they had to go. They had to go upstream.
Uh-huh.
You see, up near the Indian
They
village.
Needed good bedrock of some kind.
Yes, because right there across from Nenana, it was just all silt.
Yeah.
So they went upstream, and they were able to get onto the rock.
That's right. That I can see it yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. They go practically from cliff to
mm-hmm.
cliff over there.
So they...
Yeah, well, that's all right. So then... were you working for the railroad company there? The
engineering
commission.
Commission.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Secretary to one of the offices.
To the accountant, the main man. And then after I worked for him 2 years, I married him. His name was John McIntosh.
He was John McIntosh.
Mm-hmm.
He was no relative of that druggist McIntosh in town.
No, whatever.
No.
No.
John McIntosh. And he was the accountant for the railroad. And
yes,
that's
where
you.
He was
where
chief accountant for.
Yeah. Yeah.
For
so
position.
Then your name was Eunice McIntosh
mm-hmm.
during
and
those
I was
years.
Eunice McIntosh when I went to work at the university.
Well, that's what I thought.
In 1926.
26.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't work at Nenana all that time. Did you go outside and then come back or so?
No, we came outside and lived out here, but we had been bitten with the Alaska bug and we were Alaskans, so we went back again.
Yeah.
So...
And then you went to Fairbanks this time, I suppose.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. We did.
Yeah. Now, where did you first see Dr. Bunnell, or how did you get associated with
that's
with
an interesting
college?
Story, too. My husband became an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what was wrong with him, but I guess you'd just say he was just an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. They do it.
And,
Yeah.
And it was very sad because he was a brilliant man and
mm-hmm.
just a real fine fellow.
Yeah.
But he'd get a bottle and go to bed and just lay there and drink.
Yeah.
You couldn't get him up, couldn't
get
him to eat, couldn't do a thing with him. And finally it got so bad that Jack Buckley was marshal there. And Jack was a good friend of ours. And Jack said, Eunice, he says, you can't live with this. He says, we're going to have to do something about Jack.
Yeah.
And they sent him out to Morningside.
Is that right?
And he died there.
Oh, is that true?
Mm-hmm.
No, you know, it's a sad thing, but I've seen some brilliant men that were the same way,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me.
And it seems the brilliant ones do it more easily than the
that's right.
dull ones.
And there's nothing they can do. It's a disease, I'm sure.
Oh,
it's
yes, it is. Now I think they
it gets them in their grip.
They are able to handle some
I think
cases,
they've got
though.
Equipment and certain drugs now that
mm-hmm.
they can kind of relieve these, you know, tensions
mm-hmm.
and things that they build up. Well, that was too bad. Well, that kind of left you pretty much on your own.
Well, and
too.
It was during this interim
yeah.
that I was kind of at loose ends.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Bunnell was in charge of the Episcopal Bazaar.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't belong to the church or to the bazaar or anything,
yeah,
but I just for something to do, I joined in and
yeah,
and helped get the exhibits ready. And
bazaars were big things in those
days.
Oh,
yes, that was a real big thing.
Yeah.
So when it was all over, Mrs. Bunnell being chairman, the rest of them just all disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
She had chairs to return, tables to return, dishes to return, all the equipment that was used to run this bazaar, and she was just left all alone.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I'll help you. I have nothing else to do. Uh-huh. So I helped her for I don't know how many days.
Getting it all put back in order.
Yes, getting it back in shape. So she said, she said, you're a nice person. She said, I'd like to have you meet my husband. She's mm-hmm. He's had a terrible time getting a good secretary. I believe you'd be a good secretary.
Oh, is that right?
And that's what
yeah,
happened.
Yeah.
So she invited me out to their house for dinner.
Yeah.
And talked to Dr. Bunnell, and evidently he was impressed.
Yeah.
This was in the spring of the year. I think it was just about commencement time. And he says, well, he says, my staff is all set. And Florence Braw
yeah,
was
saw her last
to be
night.
His secretary for the summer. So
uh-huh.
he said, this is all set for the summer.
Uh-huh.
And Dorothy had to earn her way through school, so
right.
And there wasn't any place for me then. And he said, well, he said, how about you coming to work on the 1st of September?
Uh-huh.
And I did.
Uh-huh. 1926.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you, of course, were there when I was there. Now, I forget, when did you marry Reese? It was before I came, maybe.
It was in 1930.
30, well, yeah.
30. Mm-hmm.
See, I came in 33.
In 33.
But then you did so many things there, and of course we all had to in those days. But
oh yes, you had to be a jack of all trades.
Oh, now from you carried the title of secretary to the president then.
That
from
was
26,
my that was my
original.
Only title then.
Yeah.
I was secretary to the president
from 1926 till about when?
Well, I had so many titles now. I don't know whether
no.
I could reconstruct
no.
it.
But you did. You got into the accounting business pretty
well,
fast.
Well, I did that because
yeah.
That's all right.
Is that right?
Well,
I want to tell you that you know some of those old things out there, and all the old books are all kept. They're all in the archives. And your,
come in.
Your fine hand of handwriting is so beautifully done. The sets of books, you know,
oh,
and you kept
sense.
All those books in there. There. The payroll
imagine
listed
that.
Every month, you know,
uh-huh.
And I was telling Eunice, you know, how much I enjoy going through these things because I can recognize her handwriting as
you
well
can.
As your father's and everybody's
yeah.
beautiful hand, you know.
You left your mark.
And she has page upon page of these journal entries, you know, and the salaries, and it was all done in pen and ink by then.
Yeah, that's right.
And of course, Bunnell was no slump at accounting. He knew what he knew what was supposed to go where and where, I'll tell you, and meticulous down to the last
mm-hmm.
penny, you know. So I think that you then would kind of do both, secretary if you need the secretary, controller
well, I did
business.
For 7 years, and you see I had combination jobs there for quite a while. Well, then I've forgotten, I think it was Professor Chase was acting as registrar.
Yeah.
While I was secretary to the president, and at that time we were doing the accounting in his office.
Oh.
And that was the largest part, really, of the work
mm-hmm.
in his office.
The registrar did
no, Dr. Bunnell's
office. Bunnell's office,
yes.
Yeah.
And Chase did the registrar work in his office
yeah.
upstairs in the old main building.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what occasioned the change, but at any rate, Chase was not to be registrar anymore.
Yeah.
And we had to have someone who could do both. Well, Laverne Keyes had been as secretary, you see, today.
Yeah.
And then she got married and stepped out.
Yeah.
But then, as the thing grew, and she was right there on campus.
Yeah.
Dr. Bunnell asked her if she would come back as secretary and registrar. She had the knowledge and the know-how about registrar work. I didn't.
Yeah.
So that combination was made. Laverne took over the secretarial work and the
registrar
work, and it was carried on in Dr. Bunnell's office.
Right.
Well, by that time, the bookstore and the library needed attention.
Yeah.
So the general accounting went down to the bookstore with me.
I got it.
And I had the library look out after the accounting to do and run the bookstore, and the food service. I had to order the
that's
onions
the
long
food?
Distance.
Yeah. Well, that's right. That was the college kitchen or something.
That's the way it ran along there for quite a while.
Well, that's the way it was when I came in 33.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it certainly was that way just about until...
And that's the only way it could be done.
Yeah.
It wasn't big enough to have more, you see, and then not until it qualified as a university, then it was broken up, you see, and Carl Franklin came as comptroller.
35. Carl had been there and then went out for a year, but he came back as registrar controller, I think.
Yes,
And about that time, the Keys has left. George and...
I
think they resigned.
I lost track of that, too.
Yeah.
I can tell you a real cute story about Carl when he first came, you see, and we were breaking this up, and I was having to turn the work over, like going to town with the vouchers to have Mrs. Hess and Mr. Nerland sign them and going to the bank, and all of this, you see, and someone had to put him through his paces, so it was me, and you know, he resented it a little bit, this idea of a woman directing him didn't fit a bit well, and I didn't realize that.
But Carl would,
he attempted to find out something from somebody else, and they said, go and ask Eunice about it. He came to me and he said, this place ought to be called the Eunice-versity.
Yeah, well, it's true, but it had to be that if it was going to operate, everybody had to assume several hats to keep the thing.
I was thinking today, I don't know, maybe you were in on it too, thinking of my own inability now to do things. I used to be able to pick up a pretty good sized box and shove it around and pack an armload of books upstairs in the main building and all those things. And I'm not a very good longshoreman anymore.
Well, you
used to. But you know, a good part of our summer days were spent that way, unpacking the laboratory equipment.
Right.
And
And it all had to be cross-checked with the invoices, bill of lading.
We had to do that before we could pay the bills.
Right.
And so
you had to run and pay the bills after you packed it and checked it.
And then Dr. Bunnell with his sleeves rolled up and his shirt open, and we were down there yanking boxes apart and packing the stuff upstairs.
Right.
I
was in on it. Oh yeah.
I was going to say you must have.
Two or three summers.
Anyone that was on campus
in
the summertime got in on that.
I was down opening the boxes and getting that straw out and then getting the test tubes and all the equipment out there. Yeah, I worked three summers there, you know. So I was in on some of that ground floor.
I'm sure you were.
Ground floor business.
That's why you were trying to learn how to drive this car?
Yeah,
I remember my first trip with you.
Tell us about it, Eunice, and see if it compares with my first.
Well, I didn't know whether Bill was there. In fact, I didn't know Bill. He had just come, you know,
stranger.
And Dr. Bunnell said that that was going to be Bill's job, was to drive the car.
Yeah.
And I had to go to town with vouchers, and he came around to the main building and stopped in front of the main building, and he went in the building and I had come out to get in the car, so I got in the car and I was sitting there, and presently the car started off over, you know, there by the flagpole where it jumped off the grain. And just at that time he came out, but you know, if it had just gathered a little more momentum, I think the car and I would have been over the bluff.
You know where the brake was?
No, I didn't know a thing about it. I didn't have the slightest idea.
Oh.
But Bill got there in time, and he jumped in and...
You're telling it too good. I wasn't that much of a hero at all. You want to hear my version of it? It's the same story. Two people in the car, but it shows how two stories will be different. That's right. I had to take Eunice to town. Say, you know, all right, Mrs. Collins, me, all right, Mrs. Collins will take the town. So I got the car, wheeled it around there. You came out with the things and got in the car, and. I hadn't been driving very long, say, but now, as I remember, Eunice, that while the car had been parked, a little bird got in the back seat.
Oh. Uh-huh.
See, and just as I started up, you said, "Oh, I think there's a bird in the car," and me just starting the car looks around. You know, the confounded car kept going straight. We went over that little bump in the hill. And by this time, I had swung around and saw that we were over the hill, and she let out a gasp, and I put my foot on the accelerator and just guided her right back up the slope and onto the road, you know. Masterful control of the machine. Well, after that...
That's probably the correct...
I think this is true, Eunice. And you said, I hope that Dr. Fennell didn't see that. And I said, I hope so, too. She says, I'll never tell him. I said, nor will I. And so this has been a kind of... I thought this was one of our sworn secrets, Eunice.
I didn't hear it.
Drove her right off the road. And Eunice, that's true. This is the way I remember.
Well, I think you're right. I didn't remember.
It had
so
something
I got
to
the
do
car,
with the car,
and then something happened that the car seemed to be going by itself.
It went by itself, but I was in it. But I was looking back to try and shoo that bird out, and I went straight over the hill, and straight right back up the bank. Because it was a beautiful... Well, I don't know, but there's nothing that scares me worse than a confounded bird. If a bird is in the house or gets in the car, I'm frantic. I don't know what it is, but I'm afraid they'll peck my eyes out or my ears out or something. I'm scared to death of birds.
It must have gotten the bird out of the car someplace.
I think it flew out of it. Boy, when I went over the bank, the bird got out of there. Well, that was funny. But those vouchers, that was the bane of our existence, wasn't it?
Oh,
how many?
Yes.
We had to. You had to make out bank drafts, didn't you? And then take them in for signatures.
Uh-huh.
And then they had to go to the bank because certain outfits, I think, wouldn't take our check. They'd have to take bank drafts.
They had to be bank drafts.
See, certified checks. Mm-hmm. Oh boy, the running around we had to do to get those signatures,
yeah.
Mrs. Hess, you know.
I was a third errand girl when I came to town.
Yes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You'd have to get in on the
other. I was always a short
Well, you were there then from... now, about my senior year, I think you and Reese took over the food service, didn't you?
That was in 1937,
I think. 36 or spring of 37, someplace in there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then how long did you run that, I wonder?
Well, I think we did that just that 1 year.
Just maybe so.
Mm-hmm.
Then they got Earl
summer.
Pearl or somebody in to,
yes,
take
uh-huh.
it over, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he come in about that time? They tell me he's a retired general now.
Is that right?
Yeah. He stayed right in the quartermaster corps and one thing or other in the military and went right up the grades mm-hmm. because they need quartermasters too. And he was a colonel for a long time, and I think he was retired as a brigadier general.
Is that
one
right?
Star.
He went right in the military for...
Yeah, he took it up for seriousness' sake.
Bill, do you remember speaking about Dr. Bunnell and unpacking boxes, you know, in the summertime, even if there's construction going, he was always getting out there and with his sleeves rolled up, picking up boards or something. Of course, he liked it. It was good for him.
Yeah, he needed the exercise, but he'd always try to shame the rest of us.
He was such a good worker.
Yeah.
He didn't need that exercise.
Well, we didn't take to this too kindly.
But this time he was out roustabouting around and with his sleeves rolled up and looking like anything but a college president. Mm. And this tourist, a fellow evidently traveling all by himself, came moseying around on the campus, and he stopped and talked to
the gardener.
The gardener.
Mm-hmm.
And asked him all sorts of questions, and he got all the right answers. Anyway, he got answers. I don't know if he knew they were right answers. And after quite a long conversation, he handed your dad a dollar. Did you remember that story?
Yeah.
A tip. And when he never let on, your dad never let on that he was the president. He gave all this information about appropriations and about bills and about everything. And the fellow never tumbled. And he said, well, he said, you're very well informed. He said, you're to be congratulated. And he said, here, I thank you very much, and hand him a dollar. And you know, your dad kept that dollar.
I still remember that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think this is...
I think that's an awfully cute story about him.
Now, there are different versions of it, but of course the incident probably happened more than once of people stopping.
There are several stories.
There are several stories. But I like... I haven't heard this one, I think, of getting the tip and keeping it. I like that.
Well, that was one distinct one. Then another one was some fellow came on the campus and engaged him in conversation and said, I wonder, do you think there'd be any chance to talk to the president of the university? He said, I'm very interested in this. I'd like to know some of the facts about it.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Mel said, oh, he says, I think probably.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you just come with me and I'm going to go see about it. While he was walking toward the building, the office, he was rolling down his sleeves, straightening up his shirt, walked in the office, he went over to the coat tree and took his coat off and put it on, walked around and sat down in the chair and said to the man, now is there something I can do for you?
I can just see
the man was just speechless.
I can see the poor fellow coming in with the gardener there and watching this rigmarole.
Can't you see Dr. Manel doing
that? Oh, yeah, he wouldn't.
It's just as
oh, he wouldn't bat an eyelash.
No.
Go right through the motions.
He had a tremendous sense of humor,
yes.
You know.
Really did.
And
he caught me up once or twice, too. I remember the time we were coming down, we were talking about the rainy cabin, you know, before I left. And we were taking a walk and walking down along there, and I just come after the University of Chicago, and I was feeling very intellectual. And he said, you know what distinguishes man from the animals? I said, oh, sure. Let's see now, I was getting out my best classical description. And I said, I guess it's the power of rational thought, abstract thought.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no. He says, man's the only damn fool that gets on two boards with the front turned up and slides downhill.
Yeah, that's about yeah.
That was that same silly humor.
Yeah. No, he'd on our rides to town, you know, sometimes we'd keep up a kind of a banter, and of course, I developed, I suppose, a certain ability to be a straight man because he tossed some of those questions at me, and I have to say, no, what is the story of so and so? Oh, some of them were so bad, though, that I wouldn't. Poor bad puns or something. He was a punster, too.
Oh,
you
know. He was.
Of course, my favorite one had to do with about Morningside, you know, my favorite story. And I've heard him tell it so many times to different people, you know. The conversation would lag or it would get off, you know, just non-essentials. And pretty soon he'd say, well, you know, there's some people in Morningside for no reason. And there are some people there for no reason at all. The Morningside was the mental institution that Alaska sent there. See?
Yeah.
But this to him was quite a good joke.
That's a pretty good
and it's a darn good one too.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard it, you know, and I heard it. And then, of course, I got it, see. So I was always prepared for it. But the poor people that didn't know that Morningside different means different things to people from different regions.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's a nice
palisade.
But
to Alaskans,
that meant the nut house in Oregon.
Yeah. It was inside, outside, and Morningside.
Right, I'd forgotten that. Inside,
that
outside. Well, he says some people are there for no reason, and some people for no reason at all. I thought that was a pretty good joke. Yeah, well, he had a grand sense of humor.
Jamie Cameron was here last week. Oh, she was. And she and you should have gotten together on some of these stories.
Yeah.
Oh, I never have met her, you know, and I have never met Margaret Murray.
Oh,
what?
Yeah, Miss Murray.
No. Well, I can't say I never met Margaret Murray. I did this way. She came to the office when her oldest boy was just a creeper.
Mm.
And she put him down on the floor in your father's office while she was talking. And he crept out into my office and around the desk and took off down the hall. And I went out to retrieve him.
Yeah.
Fear he'd fall down some steps or something,
yeah.
And she was so busy talking she didn't notice him. So I got him back inside.
Corralled him a little bit.
I just met her.
Yeah.
I think Dad introduced
yeah.
me to him, but it was
grabbing
just that
her,
brief. I never
her
talked
baby.
To her in my life, but
yeah.
I would love to meet her, and she's been all around
yeah.
and about.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes
my inability to get around. So
when she comes again, if she has time, she would like to see Cap Bruce, and we would just see both of them.
And he still lives here. And
the last I knew, Roth, Dr. Roth.
Dr. Roth.
Mm-hmm. So we'll do that. We'll put that on our
put that on
future
on
agenda.
Agenda, you see.
Yeah. That'd be a real pleasure to meet her.
Just
I've enjoyed your book
she's
so
a nice
much.
Person.
Just because I'm getting paid to write this book doesn't mean that you people can't jot down some of this stuff in paper once in a while, too, you know. You're perfectly free
well,
to write me
yes,
a little note
once in a while.
It takes
a little time, too. You have to get to thinking along a
you
certain
do.
Line,
yeah.
and things
yeah.
will come back to
yeah.
you.
Does that remind
well,
you of something else?
Yeah.
That's
so.
Right.
I was thinking as I came today about how you introduced me to the mushrooms, the Orange Delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And taught me to eat them, and then I can't find any ever since. I
Is it a special
it's
brand?
Oh, they're wonderful mushrooms up around
oh.
you there.
But I think they're indigenous to Alaska. I have found some in Washington
oh.
State, Western Washington, but they didn't have the flavor.
Hmm.
And I have turned absolutely scared to death of mushrooms, and I don't know what caused
I think
it.
Why. But they were one you couldn't mistake for any other.
No, no, I think they were so distinctive that.
Hmm.
They were safe.
Yeah.
Well, I think what Todd was reading about some expert on mushrooms who just died last week,
mm-hmm.
eating the wrong one.
Mm-hmm.
Even this day and age,
yeah.
I thought everyone would
yeah.
know the signals.
No,
maybe.
Just a few years ago, I read that.
Yeah.
Real expert. But that one you couldn't fail to distinguish.
It got so bad here in California that at the Golden Gate Hall of Sciences
mm-hmm.
Developed a. Very beautiful display of mushrooms in their natural habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my good fortune to be there when they were just doing this. And
mm-hmm.
and they made the gills out of Kleenex.
Oh.
And they are so beautiful, you can't tell them from the real thing.
Exactly.
And then they embed them in the,
yeah.
the moss and all of the related
well, you're supposed to tell, aren't you, by the color or the formation of the gills?
You
the
can't always.
You
can't
always.
Always.
No.
Ah,
no.
Well,
and one of the most deadly mushroom, they say that it is so poisonous that a good mushroom within a few feet of it will also be poisonous.
Ooh,
so
goodness.
The destroying angel. They said never pick a good mushroom if you find any of these deadly ones.
Is that right?
Let that area alone,
oh.
because it might even have enough poison in it to make you ill, if not kill you.
Oh,
my word!
Just by sheer of the soil.
Well, the spores probably
yeah.
blow.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Or something of the sort.
Yeah.
Hmm.
You
but you're off my foot too.
Yeah.
Well,
I didn't mean to take you away from the university, but I'm angry right now.
Yeah.
Berry picking days.
I enjoyed mushrooms up there. We had lots of them.
Well, they used to have little expeditions to pick them, didn't they? Down between the college and the farm, wasn't there some little patches?
You see, I'll tell you, we're a phenomenal crop of meadow mushrooms came up, was on McGrath's, between the rows at McGrath's potato field. And they were just marvelous, and they came up there on the campus one year. You know, as a rule, the campus was in clover or hay, and I think that year Dr. Vanell had it put in potatoes, and between the potato rows were gorgeous mushrooms.
Yeah.
And that was a time when, who was it? We had some, I think it was Dr. Larson and Dr. Shapiro, that group that came to go to St. Lawrence High. And your dad saw these mushrooms and he picked up, came up and got a big dish pan and went down and picked the mushrooms and brought them up. And he said, would you cook these? And he said, we'll ask these folks to have mushrooms on toast.
Yeah.
So I got in and cooked the mushrooms in butter and toast, and I had mushrooms on toast.
Oh, boy. Yeah, sounds good.
It was good.
Oh. Yeah. Well, just to come ahead a little bit, after you took a hand at that food service business, then you went back to the offices, did you? Or when did you leave the university? Were you there during the war years?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and then your sister came up again, didn't she? And she hadn't been up all those years in
between. Oh, no, all those years. And we needed someone very much. We needed another trained person in office work and to run the... See, you couldn't rely on the student help.
Right.
And so
she ran the bookstore, the museum.
She ran the bookstore and the... not the
post
office.
Not the museum.
No, just the
post
office. The post office and the bookstore.
Yeah.
And it was all together down the... Yeah. Basement of Allison.
Well, you were back in the accounting office then, didn't you?
Well, I was up in the museum during
those years. Yeah.
And I had kind of a combination job there, too.
Yeah.
And I used to do typing for, it wasn't rainy because the outbreak out on there. The Rainey's left, and Bastris has left, and Giddings still there. Half of our good faculty left. No, Lewis went in the Navy.
That's right.
And
Ivor wasn't there.
Who did I used to do typing for?
By golly,
but
I don't know.
The museum was kind of an orphan during those years. There wasn't anybody.
Well, that's right. We put it upstairs and condensed it down to one room or something like
that.
That
Japanese girl from
Anchorage. The McCammy?
Did she have a museum at one time?
Well,
not
she
alone,
was, no.
Help.
She
not
was always a general help there. I just
I
didn't remember.
And the army took over the barracks.
That's
took
right.
Over the food service. And
power
Dr.
plant.
Vanell bought all of the stock on hand that the university had. See, the army didn't want it, and they wouldn't want to pay for it anyway. And so he bought all the stock. It wasn't an enormous stock, but it was a lot of
the foodstuffs on the shelf?
Foodstuffs.
In
that belonged
the,
to the university.
I see.
So he paid the university.
I see.
And moved this stuff down to his house.
Oh, and that
so
was the...
we had cans
he had,
of
beans. Yeah, he had his basement pretty well stocked there. That's
mm-hmm.
where... Yeah.
And two kegs of butter put in brine, about which I'll tell you a story. And so then there wasn't any place for Nell and me to live. So he said, well, what about living upstairs in my house?
Yeah.
So we said, all right, what about us living up there, and what about us keeping house for you, and we'll get our meals and not have to eat in the army mess.
Oh, that's right.
Well, that pleased him immensely, so that's the way we used to do it.
That's right.
And Nancy Seaton, Nancy always wanted a dog on the campus, and she was always asking Dr. Vanell about dogs. He says, no, absolutely, we can't have dogs.
No.
We can't sell macaques.
No.
So she found this little Scotty-type stuffed dog, and she bought it for him. Gave it to him at Christmas time. So he named it Ned. So he'd be up in the morning, and many times he didn't wait for breakfast. So sometimes I think he went up and had a cup of coffee or something at the mess. And he'd be gone. Mel and I would get up, but Ned would be standing on the table with a message. And we would do the same.
Yeah.
So if we were leaving and we didn't see him, and this went on all the time.
Yeah.
We'd, for days at a time, it seemed like we didn't see
paths
each other.
Didn't cross.
Each other.
Ned was the kind of common denominator.
We'll have dinner tonight, or
yeah.
There'll be lunch today, or something
yeah.
like that. So we get together with that real thing. Like
yeah.
Ned.
And he kind of liked that little doll, didn't he?
Oh, he really did.
Yeah.
He made quite a fuss over
it.
Oh, yeah. See my little.
Then came a real cat to the house. Maybe he brought Teddy.
Oh, is that so?
Was that after you?
That was after I left.
Yeah.
I don't know how that cat sneaked on campus and into the house.
Yeah.
And he liked Teddy.
Yeah.
Oh, he did.
He finally admitted.
Yeah. Well, I think that of course it was quite a known fact how he hated dogs. You know, well, he didn't hate dogs. I tried to explain to people. After all, he drove a dog team, and you had dogs when you were in Valdez. But it was simply true that if you let one dog get on the campus.